Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. Very happy to be back with KZYX and Z this summer with a new series of programs. I'm calling these an antinomian hour. I'm using the word antinomian, a very old concept, to describe people who work against the grain, people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. And this program consists of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX and Z every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Joseph Matthews. Joseph is a San Francisco-based writer. Before this, he was, for some 20 years or so, a Bay Area lawyer. He's the author of The Lawyer Who Blew Up His Desk by 10 Speed Press. We'll get back to that, Joseph. Joseph is the author of many books, including a series of consumer guides. He's written two novels. He's the co-author of Afflicted Powers. His first novel, Shades of Resistance, was published by Headlands Press. His newest, Everyone Has Their Reason, will be published next year by PM Press in Oakland. Joseph is a graduate of the Bolt School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Cal. Nice to be with you, and thanks for that nice introduction.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. I guess maybe we should get right to it. The title is really something, The Lawyer Who Blew Up His Desk. It wasn't you, right?
No, although metaphorically it was me, in the sense that I did leave the practice of law. So the title kind of works both ways, in the sense that it refers to the fact that I finally walked away from it. But also it's the title of a story, one of the stories about a lawyer whom I knew and worked with, who it's not just a matter of stress, but who was so twisted into knots by his practice of criminal law that he took to drugs and wound up blowing up his office trying to do freebase cocaine. So it was a sort of a little tragic story about what can happen to people, but also a metaphor for what happens to many criminal lawyers just because of the pressures of the work. And criminal lawyers are constantly banging their heads against the big system, and if you care about what happens to your clients, it can take a terrible toll on your life. And of course, if you wind up not caring about your clients, then you've given up half the point of doing the work. It's a collection of stories coming from my experiences as a criminal defense lawyer. And it talks about the price that's paid for people who immerse themselves in the adversary system on the side of the have-nots. And it's also, a series of snapshots about how that system works from the inside, which is not something that most people get a chance to read about.
Well, so let's talk about that a bit, Joseph. You practiced different sorts of law. You were a public defender. You worked with prisoners, I think. I think you did criminal law.
Right.
Maybe we should start, though, a little earlier than that. Could you tell us about your decision to become a lawyer, and maybe say something about law school and the meaning of that for you?
Yeah, sure. I'm a early baby boomer, a product of the 60s, and I was in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, as a matter of fact, in the 60s. And I and many people I knew were involved in resistance activities of various types against the war, civil rights stuff, activities with regard to people living in the Mission District Barrio in San Francisco, lots of different kinds of political activity. And lots of those people that I knew and myself kept colliding with the legal system because, of course, the government, the state, uses the police and then the courts as a way to control resistance. So I saw the fact that courtrooms, in particular criminal courtrooms, were a site where people who were very active needed a kind of electric charge to both to defend themselves, but also to put forward their, you know, what they had to say in a public forum. So it was a very exciting time, and it was a place, a time and place where it seemed to me, as a young and impressionable guy, that being a criminal defense lawyer was a place you could make a difference. And it seemed to suit me well. I, you know, the language was something that I was very good at, and argument, and also, you know, there was a bit of romance involved too. You saw yourself sort of standing at, you know, between the state and you know, and the people, a bit of a romanticized notion, but much less romanticized back then, because the courtrooms themselves were packed with supporters, and there were entire movements involved. Part of my trajectory out of being a criminal lawyer was that, as you know, the 60s and 70s became the 80s, as we all know, political, or at least those of us who were around and active in those days, know that political life became etiolated, became drained and exhausted, and so the attempt to be doing politics in the courtroom felt less and less realistic. And finally, because it was taking such a personal toll, at the same time that I couldn't really feel that I was having much of a political impact, I made the decision to walk away in the 80s. So that's, you know, that's sort of the my trajectory. You know, I went to law school out of the 60s in Berkeley. I was first involved in prison work. There was a great, you know, sort of high consciousness in prison, California prisons at that time, a political awareness that I'm afraid has dissipated in over the years. So I was involved in some of the Soledad cases that people may know about. Then I took a year and a half to be a public defender, into the waters.
Joseph, maybe we should just go back for a minute, because I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe you could, the Soledad cases and some of the more, some specific maybe about working with prisoners. Could you, would you mind going back to that?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, in the late 60s and into the 70s, there were prisoners' movements, particularly in California, but also in Attica and New York, and really all over the country, where prisoners were trying to connect their lives in the criminal justice system, out on the streets and in prison, with wider political questions, asking the questions, why are we here? Why does the prison population look the way it does? Why are we treated the way we are? And we're connecting themselves through writings and through self-organizing with the kinds of resistance movements, anti-war and civil rights movements that were going on the outside. As a result, there was a kind of, you know, exciting energy inside the prisons, and the state took a lot of steps to repress that, because prisoners were starting to organize. They were demanding rights for themselves. They were making the public aware of what was going on in prisons. And so, you know, a number of prisoners wound up being, particularly the leaders of those movements, singled out, such as George Jackson, which many people know about, the prisoners at the Attica Revolt in New York. And so court cases were brought against prisoners already in the prison system to try to force them into solitary confinement, to force them into much longer sentences. And that's where a number of lawyers in the Bay Area and in New York and across the country really got involved in defending those prisoners against the attempts of the prison system and the authorities to keep them quiet.
So would there actually be a legal process in the prison, judges
and
juries?
There were two Yeah, that's a good question. There were two levels of things. There were the internal disciplinary processes within the prison, which were very difficult to deal with because there weren't many rules. But there were also new criminal cases brought against prisoners in prison for assaults on guards, for killings. There were some guards who were killed and, of course, prisoners who were killed. And so there were actual new court cases, regular court cases, against prisoners trying to basically put them away for life and silence them. So we worked, we meaning the lawyers who worked in the prisons in those days, did both internal prison work, although generally speaking, the prisoners weren't entitled to lawyers for that kind of disciplinary stuff. But we also worked on the criminal court cases that arose out of the various rebellions and resistance and murders that took place inside prisons.
And the Soledad brothers, did you?
The Soledad brothers was one of the best known of those cases. George Jackson and Fleeta Drumgo, these were guys who were singled out because of their political activity and framed for a murder that they didn't commit. And there was a long trial and a long process, and then there was a second round of Soledad prisoners called the Soledad Seven that I was a part of that defense, where the same thing, more politically active prisoners were set up by prison authorities to take the fall for a killing that was arranged probably by the prison authorities themselves. And so it was, or certainly permitted to happen by the prison authorities themselves. So there was, you know, there were high stakes. This was high-level stuff going on. You know, we felt that there was, you know, a real politics involved in these prisoners' resistance, and that they needed not only representation, but they needed to have the word get out about what was going on.
Joseph, when you say we, were you part of a group or a firm, or did was this pro bono? How did?
Well, it took various forms. There were a number of lawyers on the left. The National Lawyers Guild is one organization of progressive or left lawyers who was very active in this and in anti-draft work and in defense of anti-war resistors. So the Guild was one organization that included lots of lawyers doing this kind of work, but there were also just a lot of criminal lawyers who stood up and said, you know, this is why we are criminal lawyers. We want to get involved. Sometimes we would get appointed by a court because anyone charged with a crime is entitled to have a lawyer, and the court will pay for it, and sometimes the prisoners got to, not always and not often, got to pick the lawyers they wanted. And sometimes we did it pro bono, and sometimes we did it, you know, paid pretty meager wages by defense committees who raised money. There were a number of ways that we got involved. But when I say we, there was a very, very active group of, you know, dozens of criminal lawyers in the Bay Area at that time who were practicing law as part of their politics. And as part of their politics, this was a large part of the work that they did.
Okay, I wanted to get back to the book in a minute and then maybe talk specifically about some of your work. But you've mentioned the word criminal lawyer half a dozen times already. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that as a category.
Well, that's a very good point, Cal. You know, people say lawyer, whatever the sets of images are that come into their mind. The reality is that there are very, very different types of lawyering that people do, and they have very little in common with each other, except that you have to have a law degree to do them. Somebody who's doing real estate transactions or tax law or representing a corporation in mergers, you know, is a million miles away from somebody who is who's a public defender or who's doing other kind of criminal defense work. the first of all, most lawyers never see the inside of a courtroom. Secondly, when you are practicing criminal law, either as a public defender or as a private criminal lawyer, you're in a completely self-enclosed world of police, prosecuting attorneys, and courts, and of course on your side, the individual defendants who have been charged with crimes. It's a world completely separate from all other lawyering. That's why I always say criminal lawyer instead of just, and indeed criminal defense lawyer, rather than just lawyer, because it's such a separate world from all the other kinds of lawyering that's done out there.
And you were trained in school to be a criminal lawyer, is that?
Well, not really. Law schools, you specialize a little bit in law school towards the end of your legal career, and so you may have an inclination towards being a criminal lawyer, and so you will take maybe some extra criminal law courses, but it's usually during apprenticeship with practicing criminal lawyers that you actually, you know, sort of cut your teeth and learn the ropes. Law school itself, I taught at Bolt, at the law school at Berkeley, for a couple of years, and on the first day, when I had first-year students, one of the very first things I said to them is, look, this is called law school, but it's much more school than it is law. Now, partly I was just trying to get them to relax and not be, you know, frightened by the whole image of law school, but in fact, it's true. Law school teaches you technical skills, but it doesn't teach you much about what the practice of law is really like. And so you know, if you want to become a criminal lawyer, for example, as I knew I did, what I did was find criminal lawyers to work with outside of law school as a way of becoming a sort of apprentice. And that was the way that I learned the ropes.
And Joseph, was your first job to be being a public defender?
Well, that was my first formal job. When I was still in law school, I wound up, you know, attending fewer and fewer classes and spending more and more time working with the progressive criminal defense lawyers in the Bay Area that I had introduced myself to through my own friends, anti-war activists, people who were getting involved in their own court cases. And so I spent a lot of time working in the offices as a kind of junior lawyer, not yet credentialed, on these kinds of cases. That was how I first got into prison law work, for example. One of the lawyers, or several of the lawyers that I worked with, got involved in the Soledad case, one of the Soledad cases, and so, you know, I started plunging into that world and spent an awful lot of my third year of law school you know, in and around prisons across the state, and much less going to classrooms at Berkeley. That was the sort of sequence. And then when I graduated, I wanted to get a lot of courtroom experience very fast, and becoming a public defender is a way to do that. And so I was a public defender in Contra Costa County for a year and a half.
Joseph, I need to pause here for a moment. This is KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host today, Cal Winslow. Our program is called An Antinomian Hour, and our guest is the San Francisco writer, Joseph Matthews, although right now we're talking about his first career, I guess we could say, as a lawyer, a criminal lawyer. Now, Joseph, picking up, I noticed in one of the chapters of the book we've been talking about, The Lawyer Who Blew Up His Desk, that you say that the office of the public defender is a scorned and starved institution. I think that's correct in terms of how you said it. Could you maybe begin with that? What do you mean by that?
Well, a couple of things. One is that the office, the institution of the public defender, comes out of the Constitution's Sixth Amendment, which guarantees every criminal defendant a right to an attorney. And if you cannot afford an attorney is appointed for you by the court and paid for by the state. And public defender's offices were initiated as a way to more efficiently provide this kind of service for people who can't afford lawyers, because there are so many people in the criminal justice system who are arrested who can't afford a lawyer. In other words, it tends to be the poor who get arrested more often. Public defender services, public defender offices were an efficient way to organize the provision of criminal defense services for poor people.
Are they a county or?
They are run in California, and I think in most states they are run by counties. So each county will have its own district attorney's office, which is the prosecuting arm of the state, and a public defender's office. Now, while the Constitution requires that the courts provide attorneys, and public defender's offices have become the way to do that, at the same time, the public rarely wants to give very much money to public defender's offices, because it's this idea of coddling criminals and who, you know, lock them up and throw away the key, and who cares? So what you have is public defender's offices, which are chronically underfunded for the amount of work that they have to do. As a result, you often have situations in which public defenders cannot possibly give the same kind of personal attention to a defendant as a private attorney could. And you see that in courtrooms, and people who are in and out of criminal justice systems know that. And so public defenders themselves get scorned. That's where the scorned part comes in, because very many people in the public at large sort of don't like what they do. Oh, we're paying you to defend this criminal. And even their own clients and clients' families are sometimes frustrated by the fact that they're so overworked that they don't have the time to give personal attention in the same way that a private attorney does. So they are both, you know, they're underfunded, overworked, and scorned, yet they sometimes have some of the greatest technical attorneys around, because they are just highly motivated, very dedicated, and extremely experienced. So they can be terrific lawyers who get no appreciation for it.
You say that at some points you might have 30, 40 cases.
Yeah, you might walk in as a public defender. You might be carrying 30 or 40 cases at different stages. Of course, cases are at different stages of the process at any given time. But you might walk into a courtroom on a given morning where you have 30 or 40 cases, and you know that all that's happening are very brief technical appearances where everything's going to be, you know, continued to a different date. You simply have to say some formulaic words and move on. But the people who are actually the defendants charged with crimes, this is, you know, these are great, terrifying moments in their lives, and yet you've got a stack of 40 files, and you haven't even met half of these people. And so the appearance of what goes on with a public defender is, you know, that you don't know these people, you don't care, it's all just shuffling papers, and people, you know, can be very, very frustrated and disappointed with that. And, of course, there's a lot of truth to it. People want to have, you know, what's going on in their lives, this important moment, explained to them. And public defenders don't have the time to do it, even though they may be doing a terrific job in the technical sense in the courtroom. But it also gets worse than that. There are, of course, many times, and I write a couple of stories in the book about how public defenders often are put in positions of going into court when they're not prepared. And there's tremendous pressure from the courts to, you know, keep cases pushing along. And the public defenders are forced in this position of having to deal every day with the same judges and prosecutors and needing to stay on some kind of civilized terms with them. At the same time, they're always being pushed in the corner to to cut things short and get to the chase, even though that may not serve the interests of their clients.
You write about one particular case which seems to have been indicative of some of the frustration faced by the public defender. It's the story of a, I think his name was Tony, of a older man, a handyman. Would you mind just outlining that for us and what were the difficulties there?
It's a story from my own experience when I was a public defender, and there was an older man who was charged with shoplifting. And, you know, this was a man in his 70s who worked as a handyman, didn't have any money, but, you know, was a sort of a guy who had been a hardworking person who had kept his nose clean his whole life, had never been involved with the courts or the police at any time in his life, and he was charged with shoplifting, and it appeared from the police report, as it often does, since the police reports are very biased, that he was sort of caught red-handed, taking some, I can't remember what it was, you know,
some screws, packages
of nails and screws or something, very minor, but was caught by the security guard. And, his contention was that he just, unthinkingly put the packages in his work belt, as he always does when he's working, while he went about the store looking for other things. Anyway, it was one of those cases where he simply wasn't getting the kind of attention that he deserved. Nobody was really listening to this story. Everybody was simply moving ahead under the assumption that this was a minor thing. It would get disposed of. He certainly wouldn't go to jail. We would take care of it in some simple way, the way most cases are settled or dealt, as they say in criminal courts, without a trial and without him going to jail. But for him, it was enormously important for his pride, his dignity, his self-respect, that he not be labeled a criminal. And it wasn't until the very end of of months and months of delays and all sorts of things, where I at one moment said, "Look, Tony, I've got you this great deal. There's no jail, no probation. You can just, walk away from this. Just, take this deal." And he said, "No, I won't do it. I won't plead guilty to something that I didn't do." And at unbeknownst to me, the prosecutor actually didn't have a case to go against him because the witness who would have tried to testify that he had stolen things had left the state. So I, even though they weren't going to be able to even go to trial against Tony, I had unthinkingly said to him, "Oh, just take this deal, Tony. Let's get it over with because nothing bad will happen to you." And this was part of the kind of cynicism that sometimes overtakes public defenders because they're so overworked. This seemed like a very good ending for him. He was a 75-year-old man who cared. Well, he cared, and that was what got lost in the system.
This might be... you say very interesting things about the sort of legal system's cast of characters, and I wondered if I could ask you about that. I think you already said once you start off with the police and the prosecutors and the judge and then the whole system. How do you, could you just kind of let us know how you look at this picture of this system and these people in it, the police, for example? How do they appear to the public defender?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, basically, the public defender or criminal defense lawyer of any kind looks at this sort of large interwoven web of the state arrayed against usually a very, small person without resources. You have the police. You have the jailers. You have the prosecutors, and all of whom have lots and lots of resources, and you have the judges, most of whom in criminal courts are former prosecutors, because that's the way the political system works. People get appointed as judges by the governor, but in most cases they pick prosecutors or city attorneys, people who don't have any particular sympathy criminal defendants, or they come out of the business world. They're business lawyers who have, you know, made the right political donations, and so they get appointed judges. So from the first encounter with police all the way through the judges, and then, of course, you also have probation and parole officers on the other end of the system, all of them sort of arrayed against you and your client. And so there's this kind of siege mentality that criminal defense lawyers have because they see a very well-funded and interconnected system arrayed against you, and you're kind of a lone voice in the wilderness. And one of the things, you know, many of your listeners undoubtedly have heard the term speaking truth to power. That seems to be a very popular phrase among progressives these days. You know, I'm going to stand up and speak truth to power in one way or another. And what criminal lawyers found is that speaking truth to power doesn't matter because power doesn't need to listen. And over again in courtrooms, we found ourselves, we meaning, again, criminal lawyers, defense lawyers, you know, pointing out, you know, some form of inconsistency, some form of clear untruth, some form of injustice. And, you know, the prosecutors and judges together simply say, so what? They don't say it in those words, but they just move on. The most dreaded words you heard, could hear from a judge in a courtroom was, well, anything else, counsel? Meaning, everything you've said so far has made no impression on me. So there was this sense of siege mentality where you have the state in various forms working together in a well-funded way to put your client onto the wrong side of the law.
And it seems like, I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that you seems to view prosecutors and judges, for example, as in many ways problematic individuals. Is there anything to that?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always an interesting question about whether or not there is a self-selection process in the world about who becomes a police officer, a prosecutor, or a judge. So there's that question. You know, does it take a certain kind of person to become to take on that role? And then there's the secondary question, which is, well, regardless of how you feel about that, what does being in that role over the years do to you? So prosecutors and judges, for example, I believe become immensely cynical about the people who appear before them, and police officers as well. Basically, anybody who appears in this system must be a criminal, and I'm not going to go out of my way to, you know, to protect them, or even to see that their rights are afforded. So, you know, there are plenty of people who, you know, the police have an enormously tough job, and I have a lot of respect for the difficulty of their job. But the fact is that, you know, when you are a police officer, you know, as a matter of survival, people that you run across all look like dangers and enemies to you. And the same thing happens when you spend any time as a prosecutor. I wish I could say it were not true for judges, but in my experience, the same thing is true with judges, partly because of who they are before they become judges, and then partly because of what happens to them when they spend a lot of time in court.
Do you remember a character named William Sherman? You call him William, a.k.a. Tecumseh Sherman, having an interesting attitude toward the public defender.
Yeah, I mean, he was based on, you know, a judge I knew, and you know, there were several caricatures of judges, but based on judges I knew in the book. People who, you know, who had power, had, you know, very narrow political views, and who had little personal patience or compassion. And so they found every way possible way they could, they would make certain that defendants got as little wiggle room as possible. And they also viewed the people who defended criminal defendants, either public defenders or other criminal lawyers, as enemies as well. And so they treated people with enormous contempt. And it was extraordinarily difficult to deal with judges like that because they were wielding power, and if they wielded it the wrong way, you weren't going to get hurt, your client was. So you constantly had to resist the temptation to say what you really thought. And for me, at any rate, spending years having to bite my tongue, spending years not being able to say what I really thought about the things that were going on around me, took a real toll on me.
So getting the right judge could make all the difference in the world.
All the difference in the world, yeah. And, you know, generally it was random. Yeah. And so you know, there were little ways you could manipulate the system or try to get in front of, you know, a, quote, better judge. But it didn't always work, and lots of people wound up in front of these, these kinds of vicious characters. And, or even just uncaring, even if they weren't vicious. It could make an enormous difference with what happened.
And maybe one last thing, Joseph, the deal, the bargain was often struck and oftentimes seemed to be struck not with the defendant even present. What about that as part of the system? Is that just life? Is it a problem? Is it useful? What do you think now?
Well, I think it's a function of the fact that many more people are arrested than could possibly ever go to trial. There are not enough courts and courtrooms and judges and prosecutors and lawyers to have a trial for the millions of people who are arrested. Partly it's because we're such a law enforcement society. Arrest is used as a kind of social control of people, and it's simply not possible for everybody to have their full day in court, that is a trial. So what has developed is a system in which there's this kind of bargaining, the deal that you've referred to, whereby the prosecutors will say, okay, I will let you plead guilty to a lesser charge than the one we've charged you with if you're willing to plead guilty and not go to trial, and here's what your sentence will be. And you, as a lawyer, wind up saying, well, that's not good enough, and you wind up bargaining over what the charges will be, how serious they are, and what the sentence will be. For people who have actually committed crimes, of which most of your clients may have committed some infraction, that kind of bargaining isn't a bad thing. It means that they will not risk the more serious charges and what a judge may do to them without any controls if they're found guilty. So, both in terms of administration and in terms of, getting out of the system relatively unscathed, it can be a very useful thing. The problem is that it happens in 99% of all cases. And as you point out, the defendants themselves are rarely involved. They only get involved at the very end when they're offered something and the lawyer says, okay, this is what you're offered, this is what I could get, this is what I think, but you have to decide. And, of course, most people aren't experienced enough to know whether what they're being offered is a good or bad thing. So it's one of the parts of being a criminal lawyer that is most difficult, which is being a bargainer for someone's life, when the person who's going to suffer the consequences isn't really part of the decision making and doesn't necessarily understand what has gone into it. Even if you believe that what you've done is a very good job, as for example the case of Tony, the old guy who was caught supposedly shoplifting, we talked about earlier. So it's a very difficult part of the process, but it is an integral part of the process because there's simply no way to go to court. There's no room.
Joseph, this is really interesting. I need to pause again. This is KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our guest today is San Francisco writer and former lawyer Joseph Matthews. I wanted to get on to writing, but this is very interesting. One last question, though. Let me go back to the book. We've been talking about Joseph's book, which is titled The Lawyer Who Blew Up His Desk. With one more kind of interesting thing that people can have great difficulties with. And in one of the cases that you mention as a in your work as a criminal lawyer, I think it is, and you might say just a word about becoming a criminal lawyer, but you talk about the issue of the technicality, the person getting off on the technicality. Maybe you could just say a word about that, and then we'll go on to your life as a writer.
Yeah, it's a common phrase in the media and in public parlance that someone has gotten off on a technicality. But technicalities, for the most part, mean something much more significant and important. The technicality is often based on a right that's enshrined in the Constitution. So, for example, in illegal search, or the fact that somebody has been held incommunicado without a lawyer for a long time, or the fact that somebody has been arrested and then taken to jail without any probable cause. Cases can then be dismissed because of that kind of police or prosecutorial misconduct. And it's characterized as a technicality, getting off on a technicality, when in fact, if anything should be important to the public at large, it's the fact that we have to have ways to enforce the fundamental rights that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, and that these fundamental rights apply to everyone, and that if they're not enforced, then they're going to be trampled by the police and prosecutors in the course of their activities, even though they may have the best intentions, right? We want to catch criminals. We as a society have to be vigilant about protecting and enforcing those rights in the Constitution. When it gets to court, that means adjudicating cases based on constitutional errors that have been made. That's not a technicality. That's basic fundamental stuff to in our justice system.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting. You know, Joseph, I think lots of people would like to write. They'd like to be writers, and I think they'd like to do that for their living. And I think especially they'd rather probably do that than what they're actually doing. But you made a switch, and you became a writer. Was that difficult? What moved you to do that? And how did you get started?
Well, the first thing to say about becoming a writer is there's an expression among writers, which is to be a writer in America, you can make $1 million, but you can't make a living. Which means, yes, there are Stephen King and J.K. Rowling and, you know, a few people who make, you know, gobs and gobs of money. But the fact is that most writers, even published, well-thought-of, serious writers who have many books, can barely make a living, if at all, from their writing, and that they have to also do other kinds of work. They have to teach, they have to do technical writing, they have to do, any number of other kinds of things. So, you know, my first, comment to anybody who says they want to be a writer is write because you need to write and want to write, but don't expect it to pay your bills. Write because you have a passion for it. Write because you have something to say. Write because there is pleasure in the doing of it. But don't expect the world to recognize you in monetary terms. It's just a bad bargain. It's a real fool's crusade. So that being said, for me, I didn't quit lawyering to be a writer. I quit lawyering first. And later started writing for my own pleasure, and then on the side also different kinds of writing to help make a living. And it slowly developed into the thing that I did. I often say to people, and they say, well, how did you make this transition? You must have known what you were going to do. You were going to become a writer when you quit being a lawyer. And the answer is no. I tell them it was like having an elephant standing on my foot when I was at the end of my criminal law career. I just needed to get the elephant off my foot. I didn't know where I was going to put the foot next. I just needed to get it free. So I became a writer, first as an avocation because I enjoyed it, and then began to develop ways to both make a living from it and write what I cared about. Of course, one of the first rules of becoming a writer and wanting to spend lots and lots of time on it is you at the same time have to become a person who doesn't need a lot of money. You can't be a big consumer and also a writer. You can't have aspirations for, material pleasures and be a writer. That's not what writing's going to bring you. But you're also, writing is, it's a little bit like we were saying earlier about being a lawyer. There are many, many different kinds of writing. Depending on what sorts of writing you do, the demands are different, the markets are different, the process is different, the satisfactions are different. I've written two novels and a book of short stories, the lawyer stories, but I've also written a book of political analysis called Afflicted Powers, which I wrote with three others. And there are people who write romance novels, there are people who write thrillers, there are people who write science fiction, there are people who do journalism, there are poets, there are any number of kinds of writers, and each one has its own set of demands and satisfactions.
So let's hear a word about your first novel, Shades of Resistance. Where did that come from? How did you find it?
It's a novel that's set in Greece during the last year of the military dictatorship there. There was a military dictatorship from 67 to 74. And I was... it was my first novel, and I had spent a lot of time in Greece, and so in the 70s and 80s, and so the territory was very familiar to me and also very rich. And I got there just at the end of the junta, and so that whole period was very interesting to me. Listeners can tell from the first half of this conversation we're having that, politics were always important to me. And so the political situation in Greece, as well as people's personal lives and the way they intersected with the political situation, was something that interested me greatly. Also, the character, although he's not based on me, was also someone coming out of the 60s and being kind of lost. And the novel is... in one part about this character who's an American reconnecting with political life as he tries first to sort of run away from his life and find himself in the Greek islands thinking he's going to a kind of escapist paradise only to find that there's this horrific political situation there that he's forced to confront. So I wanted to write fiction. I wanted to stay talking about politics, and I had this rich experience in Greece, so I put the three together, and the novel was the result.
So that's Shades of Resistance, as published by Headlands Press, and we're talking to Joseph Matthews, the author, about being a writer now, and writing is often, I would think, a very solitary kind of occupation, but one of the books that you've been involved in was a collective project. You just mentioned it, Afflicted Powers. I've found that collective writing can be very rewarding, but also very difficult. What moved you to be involved in a collective project like that? And maybe you could just say a word about what the book was about.
Sure. Well, first, you're absolutely right. I think most writing is very solitary, and that's part of its attraction for many people. It's also part of what's very difficult about it, because you're working in a vacuum, and it's sometimes difficult to tell, you know, when and where you might be getting lost. So I had written two books, the novel Shades of Resistance and the book of short stories about lawyering. And then I was involved and still am involved with a political group in the Bay Area called Retort, which is a group of writers and artists and intellectuals and political activists who have been meeting and talking and sometimes producing work together jointly for nearly 30 years now. When the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq happened, we as a group, a larger group, were involved in demonstrations against and resistance to that war, all of which, of course, was futile. So some of us within this group decided that we wanted to write something, maybe something small like a pamphlet, which we had produced a couple of times previously as collaboration, to talk about the previous Iraq war. And so we started talking about, again, producing a pamphlet talking about this new situation after the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. What was the world political order looking like these days? Well, collaborating on a pamphlet is one thing, but we soon found that we had so much that we wanted to say after many discussions that it started to balloon into a book. And collaborating on a book is another order of magnitude over a pamphlet. And you're right, it was an extremely difficult but also extremely rich and rewarding experience to make that collaboration happen. The four of us who wrote the book each had different expertise, different experiences. We sort of divided. We had many, many, many hours of discussions about what it was we wanted to talk about in the book, about how the book would be organized, and then figured out how to allocate those tasks among the four of us. So it was, extraordinarily difficult, but immensely rich and rewarding experience. What we wound up doing was, each of us individually would collectively talk about all the issues and argue them, and then each of us would go off separately to write one section of a book, and then we would come back and the four of us would rewrite each of those sections with all of our voices being heard. It was tremendous, but it was tremendously difficult.
Maybe just a word about the title, Afflicted Powers. Where did you get that? Does that have a specific meaning?
Afflicted Powers is, you know, titles are always, are always difficult. I'm never very good about them. It comes from Paradise Lost. There's a line in Paradise Lost, which is, we use as, several lines from Paradise Lost that we use as our epigraph to the book. And it goes, I'll read it, it's, "And reassembling our afflicted powers, consult how we may henceforth most offend our enemy, our own loss how repair, how overcome this dire calamity, what reinforcement we may gain from hope, if not what resolution from despair." So it seemed to, you know, reflect what our task was. We were despairing about the wars, despairing about the inability of the left to do anything about them, but we wanted to stand up and speak against our enemy, and also in that process, you know, repair our own losses. So that was the spirit of the book, and somehow it seemed to fit well as a title, Afflicted Powers, the subtitle of which is Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War.
Okay, so that's Afflicted Powers, and it's published by Verso, and I'll just remind readers its authors are Joseph Matthews, we're speaking to him now, but also he's joined by Michael Watts, Tim Clark, and Ian Bull, and it's well worth reading, as any of these titles are. But we've got a few minutes left, Joseph. Let's just go to the next one, and but I'll ask again, it's a new novel coming out next year, Everyone Has Their Reason. It'll be published by PM Press in Oakland. But I'm wondering again, where does this come from? Did it just come up inside you, that this idea, or did you have to search for an idea, or how does that work?
How does it work is a good question. For me, at any rate, you know, there are usually external impetus that gets me started on a book. This novel, Everyone Has Their Reasons, is based around, I don't want to say it's the story of, but it's based around the life of a young Polish-Jewish German teenager who fled Germany on his own in the 1930s. And wound up in Paris on his own and tried to regularize his, you know, refugee status there and try to survive, and had enormous difficulty doing so. And after 2 years there, his parents and brother and sister, who had remained back in Germany but with Polish passports, were deported along with 10,000 other Polish passport-holding German residents, almost all of them Jews, to the Polish border and dumped there and in miserable circumstances. And this kid's, Herschel Greenspan is his name, his response was to walk into the German embassy in Paris and to shoot to death a German consular officer. And that shooting was then used as a pretext by the Nazis for the first great nationwide pogrom, you know, of the Holocaust, called Kristallnacht, Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. And so he becomes this political football after he's arrested, and there's a fascinating saga about who supports him and who doesn't and what happens to him. Although most of the book is about his life in Paris as a refugee before the shooting. And it raises lots of questions that I'm interested in, but the impetus was simply that I saw on the 50th anniversary of Kristallnacht, a little article in the paper that told this very brief story. And I'd never heard of the guy before, this kid. And most people I asked had never heard of him before. And I went to do some research about it just for my own interest and found there was almost nothing written about the kid. And I said, hey, this sounds like a fascinating story. I wonder why not. And what I started to think was that he and his life raised too many difficult questions about why it was that he got no support from anybody in Paris before the war. And by sheer luck, I happened to be introduced to a guy who had been researching this kid's story for 10 years and had an enormous library of his own work and research, but had never written anything except a short article himself, and he was willing to turn over all his research to me. So I plunged into this case and decided I wanted to write something about it. Having written, you know, stories before, I felt that in the end that writing a novel would be the best way to tell this story. And although it's the kid's story, it's also the story of class and how class operated in Paris, about the different identity politics that were operating in Paris at the time, about left-right politics in Paris at the time, about Zionist politics, all of which both interested me and, you know, reflect on politics today.
Joseph, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. We're out of time now. Listeners, I just want to remind you that on today's program, we've been talking to the writer, Joseph Matthews, first of all about his career as a lawyer and his very interesting book, The Lawyer Who blew up his desk. All these books are of great interest, I think you'll find out. His novel, Shades of Resistance, a political tract, Afflicted Powers, and just now his novel to come out next year, Everyone Has Their Reasons. Joseph, again, thank you very much. And listeners, thank you for tuning in. This is Cal Winslow, and I'll be back next week at the same time. Good afternoon.